And welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the consequences of change and how today's choices impact tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It's made possible through underwriting by Joan Gullard Sargent. Chris Kington Barker is today's host, and she will be talking with local guests from Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center to discuss the increasing number of unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S. and Mexico border and the challenges and opportunities for unaccompanied youth. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation today by calling your questions or comments in at 805-549-8855 or emailing them to us at voices@kcbx. Now, let's join Chris Kington Barker and her guests. Over to you, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Brad. As has been evidenced this week, the southern border crisis has continued. In August, the Customs and Border Protection, or the CBP, reported more than 200,000 migrant encounters at the southern border, a 317% increase over last August, and a 21-year high. This is the second month in a row where the number has been over 200,000 encounters. What's more, this comes with an increase in the number of unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S. and Mexico border. Last month, the CBP reported the average number of unaccompanied children in CBP custody was 1,435 per day, compared with an average of 1,353 per day in July. Julissa Pena, executive director, and Crystal Canella, staff attorney, have joined me today from the Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center to outline and discuss the work they do to provide deportation defense to the Central Coast immigrant community, their recently expanded service to prioritize legal representation for accompanied children. And Julissa and Crystal, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
You know, I think there, you know, the first place that we really ought to begin is just really who's considered to be an unaccompanied migrant child. I think that definition ranges for different people who may or may not be informed. Can you define that a little bit better?
Yeah, so an unaccompanied migrant child is someone who is under the age of 18. They don't have lawful status in the U.S., and they entered the U.S. without being accompanied by a parent or a legal guardian.
And then there have been, as I mentioned in the intro, record-setting numbers of unaccompanied children seeking protection that are being reported at the U.S.-Mexico border. What does that mean to the Central Coast? What has that meant?
Yeah, to give you some context, I'm going to tell you a little bit of some recent data. So in March 2021, more than 18,500 children were referred to the Department of Health and Human Services by the Customs and Border Patrol. That figure is at least 60% higher than the previous record of 11,494 in May 2019. So from these 2021 record-setting numbers, we can predict that up to 750 unaccompanied children will be released to sponsors on the Central Coast this year and placed in deportation proceedings. As of July 2021, that's the most recent data released from the Department of Health and Human Services. It shows that 500 plus unaccompanied children have been released to sponsors on the Central Coast. This means that we are experiencing unprecedented numbers of unaccompanied children being released to sponsors on the Central Coast.
Talk more about how unaccompanied migrant children are seen as being more critically vulnerable as a population of the migrants and refugees.
Yes, that's a great question. So several studies show that unaccompanied children are generally physically healthy. but they face high rates of severe psychological trauma, and which is compounded by age and language barriers to self-advocacy, which makes them one of the most critically vulnerable populations of migrants and refugees.
And when we talk about the unaccompanied children, can we speak to if they do cross the border with an adult? Is this a known adult to them? I mean, there's kind of an assumption that they're coming with family or they're coming with a relative. Is that so?
So that is a common assumption, but the policy right now, so generally, if a family did want to approach the border and cross together, they would be seeking asylum. But the current policy is to reject asylum seekers coming at the border. So likely what a family would be doing is maybe once they got rejected, having the child then do the journey by themselves to the border, or maybe paying a smuggler to bring the child to the border. So ultimately, they're not with someone they know if they entered and are unaccompanied minors.
When you talk about sponsor, do all of these children who are being sent over by parents who obviously love them, care for them, are they being sent to sponsors or to people that they know here? Is there a place for them here, or is this desperation act by parents who don't know, they just want to get their children safe and out of the country?
So it does vary. Jalissa can talk more about the stats in a second, but the majority of the time when these children are crossing, they do know someone already in the U.S., whether it is an uncle or a distant relative. So when they cross the border and are put into detention during that process, OOR, which is the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is in charge of locating sponsors, generally would be communicating with that child to determine if they know someone here and getting that contact information. And so it could be, like I said, a relative, like an uncle, or maybe just a distant relative that's here in the U.S., and making arrangements and so that that relative would be categorized as their sponsor and released to them.
Yeah. So 90% of the time, these children are being reunified with a parent. And so it's really beautiful because now you see that it's children trying to make the journey to reunify with a parent that they haven't seen for years. And so this has been exacerbated by COVID-19 because many of these children were left behind years ago by a parent who tried to come to the U.S. To seek some sort of economic support to send back home, right? And so most of these kids tend to stay with the grandmother, grandparents in general, mm-hmm. aunts or uncles, and many of them have lost their lives. And these children have been left alone. And so they have had no other choice but to make the journey to come to the U.S. and reunify with a family member, with a parent that left years ago to seek some sort of protection.
Right? Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions that come up for people in discussion around this topic about what's causing these children to flee their countries. Can you talk a little bit more about this from an informed experience?
Yeah, so it does vary. The children can be fleeing their home country because of wars, gangs, or general violence within the area that they live, within the area that they go to school. Or they may be fleeing abuse within the family that they're at. Maybe the parent that they're currently residing within their home country is abusive. And like Jalissa said, are trying to reunify with a parent that is already in the U.S. So it does vary. Commonly, it is some form of abuse, and in my experience with a lot of the children that I've worked with, it is some form of abuse or neglect that they're experiencing. And that is why they come to the U.S., especially if one parent is already here and they're trying to reunify with them.
Yeah, and I think we also have to think of, like, in a broader sense, we have to think about the roots of migration, right? And this has to do with, like, decades of corruption and violence in these countries, but also it has to do with all these years that the U.S. was involved in these countries and its government and its policies, right? And so those are indirect causes of migration that are still very much present today.
There's also an assumption that the majority of the individuals, the majority of the migrant children that we're seeing or individuals we're seeing now coming through Mexico to the U.S. are from Mexico. Can you speak to that a little bit too, please?
Yeah, so just speaking directly, I would say from my experience with the clients I do have, they aren't all from Mexico. It may be that they came from Guatemala, Honduras, like different places that it just happened to be a crossing point into getting into the U.S., but it doesn't mean that that was their home country. It was just a means of arriving to the U.S.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing right now is evidence of that, correct? I mean, what we're seeing at the border taking place today is not individuals, for the most part, that are coming from Mexico. They're coming through Mexico.
Yes. And actually, the majority of the unaccompanied minors are from other countries that are not Mexico because of a law that we have in place that denies protection and immediate entrance to unaccompanied minors from countries that the U.S. shares a border with. So this is a practice legally backed by an amendment to the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, which was actually signed by President Bush in 2008. So some of the kids that were helping at the center had to try, who are Mexican unaccompanied minors, were denied entrance and protection at the border by CBP because they have the discretionary authority to turn them away because we have this this law in place. And so these kids often try multiple times to enter without inspection to try and get that protection. But yes, that's why most of them, the majority of the numbers that we have of unaccompanied minors are not Mexican, are actually from other countries.
Can you talk a little bit about the process when a minor, an unaccompanied minor, comes in to, they step into the U.S.? What happens then now? What is the process?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when unaccompanied children seek protection at the U.S.-Mexico border, Customs and Border Patrol first determines if the U.S. shares a border with the child's country of origin. Just like I mentioned, if the child is Mexican, then they have the authority to turn him away or her away. So unaccompanied children from other countries, such as Central American countries, are admitted to the U.S. and then they're detained by CBP and placed automatically in deportation proceedings. They are sent to a detention facility that is under the jurisdiction of Customs and Border Patrol. And by law, children are supposed to be transferred over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement within 72 hours. However, this rarely happens. And so a 2019 study shows that children were held for weeks and even months in a detention where it is designed for adult immigrants, right? And so this also affects, right, exacerbates the vulnerability of these kids, right, that trauma that they endure because of detention, right? So once the child is transferred to the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the child is then placed in a shelter where they start the process of release. And so they start vetting sponsors.
And who is taking care of the children when they're in these shelters?
The Department of Health and Human Services has custody of these kids. And so they're responsible for vetting these sponsors that come forward or that they're able to get in contact with the child's help.
Yeah. How difficult is that to find these sponsors? I mean, do they always know these children are coming?
No, that's a great question. So this, many of the times it is not planned. It's somewhat planned. Some kids that are older, of course, plan it. And so they take with them, for instance, a copy of their birth certificate. They take phone numbers, right, of any U.S. any family members that are living in the U.S. and contact information. But yeah, it's difficult. They completely rely on the child to really make connection with a sponsor in the U.S. Yeah.
And do you have any idea from your experience or statistically what the incidence of acceptance of these children is from the individuals that have been identified as being potential sponsors for them when they get to the country?
I mean, most of the kids are being released to me. We know by data that most of these kids are being released to immediate family members, right?
To so somebody showing up for them.
Yeah, someone showing up. With the previous, a really big problem that we were seeing with the previous administration was that family members who were here in the U.S., our immigrant neighbors who were here in the U.S. for many years, who were still undocumented, were actually not coming forward to release, to get custody of these kids. Sure. Because they were afraid of getting placed in deportation proceedings. And so these kids were there for months, right? Because of that risk, because we were seeing a practice for the very first time, we were seeing that the Department of Health and Human Services was actually cooperating with the Department of Health, with the Department of Homeland Security, right? In passing over this information. And so that was really unfortunate. And so now we're starting to see that there has been a shift. And so sponsors are feeling more comfortable in coming forward and claiming these kids.
Okay. I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener radio supported radio station. The voices you're hearing with me today are Julissa Pena, Executive Director, and Crystal Canella, Staff Attorney from the Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center. And am I saying your last names correctly?
Yes, you are.
Yes. Okay. We're taking a deeper look at the increase in the number of unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S. and Mexico border, its impact on the Central Coast immigrant population, and how Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center is responding. If you have a question for today's guests or a comment about our topic, we welcome you to call us at 805-549-8855. Or you can email to voices@kcbx.org. You've mentioned a couple of times, Julissa, the trauma that, you know, is experienced by these children. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what is being seen with these kids in terms of the outcome of this, and how is that being addressed, or is it?
That's a big challenge. So many of these kids are, of course, experiencing anxiety and PTSD, very high levels, actually, of PTSD. Mm-hmm. And the unfortunate thing on the Central Coast is that we have very limited resources for case management and also mental health services. And so, yeah, it's a worry of ours. And it's been one of our goals at the center to develop a holistic service delivery to provide the unaccompanied children that we provide legal services to also provide them with case management services to help them to advocate for their needs, but also to help them access, most importantly, mental health.
And go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to add, in addition to what Julissa was saying, not only are the support services for them lacking, but in the Central Coast generally, even just legal resources for them to get help and get legal representation since they are in removal proceedings once they do enter the U.S. is very limited. And any organizations that are assisting them are likely not able to in high numbers. For instance, we are still trying to increase our capacity to help these children because the numbers have been increasing so much, but it is difficult to meet the demand as well.
Yeah, and talk a little bit more, Crystal, about do these children qualify for any kind of representation when they do go into proceedings?
Yeah, unfortunately, so unlike, for instance, criminal court, where you automatically you have the right of representation. In immigration court, you don't have any right to representation, and that even includes minors, which is really surprising. You would think that maybe at least the minors would get court government appointed counsel, but they don't. And their ages vary. So they may be as young as 6 years old or as old as 17. And it makes a drastic difference if they are unable to get representation when there's language barriers. They don't understand our legal system. So it's really unfortunate that they aren't granted, government appointed counsel, because it does make a huge difference for how their case may turn out.
When minors come across, how is it determined who's going to be accepted in to the system and evaluated further, and who's just going to be turned away?
Well, first of all, the minor's not going to know what they qualify for. They're going to need representation. The minors who do not get representation, and we have data by this nonprofit organization run by Syracuse researchers that shows that that 15% of children without an attorney were allowed to remain in the country. The remaining 85% were deported to their home countries where they faced life-threatening conditions. And this is based on a study on the 2014 increase of unaccompanied minors. So based on those numbers, children with attorneys were 70 times more likely to win their cases in immigration court. And so when they have many of, and Crystal can talk a little bit more about the protection that is available to many unaccompanied minors because of their unique situation. But yeah, unfortunately, unaccompanied minors who are not able to secure protection, I mean, very little of them are able to stay in the U.S.
And Crystal, if you could talk more about that. And when we're talking about the ones that would qualify, we're talking about unaccompanied minors that are not from Mexico.
So in terms of what they would qualify for, it isn't specific to where they came from. So if they are from Mexico, they could qualify for this as well. But they qualify for relief known as special immigrant juvenile status. And so it's a special type of visa for these children who are under the age of 21. So there's a little bit more leniency in the age range versus just an unaccompanied minor being considered if they're under the age of 18. So there's a few more years, and they are unmarried, and either one or both of their parents abused, abandoned, or neglected that child. And it is found that it's not in their best interest, of the child's best interest, to be returned to their home country. So if we find that they do qualify for this, this special visa would eventually allow them to get residency here in the U.S. So it does help or it potentially helps a lot of the unaccompanied minors here, but we find that very few actually know even about this protection. So unless they're able to find legal representation or even talk to some kind of organization to talk about what they potentially are eligible for, they won't really know that that's available to them.
In the detention centers where minors are detained, are individuals who are volunteers or legal counsel that are able to provide this kind of factual information, are they able to go in?
Yeah, there's a few organizations at the border, like Al Otro Lado, Borders Angels, Raices, that has access to some of these detention centers on the border, and that does provide some legal counsel or more, you know, advice. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, we've actually received the referrals from these organizations. But of course, they are at capacity. The need for even these services in detention is limited.
Yeah. And how is that being addressed? How is that being addressed through your organization? Because you're trying to increase your support. How are you doing that?
Yeah, so Crystal is leading our unaccompanied minor program, and we're trying to be creative in the way that we increase our capacity. So the ILDC has this hybrid model of staff attorneys and volunteer attorneys. And so we're in the middle of trying to fundraise to, of course, increase our capacity to hire an additional attorney to help us represent unaccompanied minors. But we're also trying to be creative in the way that we share the workload, right? So let's say Crystal will, as the California licensed attorney, she starts off with the child representing them in state court, because special immigrant juvenile status is a protection that intersects with family law and also immigration law. And so once Crystal is able to secure what is called a predicate order, it's a state court order granting special immigrant juvenile status findings, then we take that order to immigration court and tell the judge that this child qualifies for CIGIS, then we're able to start the visa process. So once Crystal is able to secure that state court order, we then also transfer the case maybe to a volunteer attorney to try and maximize Crystal's caseload, for instance. And so we're trying to be creative in the way that we work together to try and maximize our efforts for unaccompanied minors.
Yeah. And Crystal, on average, how many cases are you carrying?
Right now, since we still are building capacity, currently open, I have about 12, but we do also have children on a wait list. And like Julissa said, the challenge with these types of cases also is that the workload is front loaded. So the state court part, in family court or probate court, depending, it's very time consuming. There's a lot of like information you're gathering, a lot of forms you're filling out. But after that part is done, the portion that we do in immigration court is a lot shorter and simpler to get through. It's more of getting that approval and then more of a waiting game at that point. So that's the challenge too, in taking on more clients, is that everything is, a lot of it is done right when you retain the client. So it's hard to have a lot at the same time.
Yeah. At the moment, we're representing, as a whole, as an organization, we're representing about 40 immigrant families. That's a more than maybe 70, 80 individuals, and unaccompanied minors, about 20 unaccompanied minors.
Wow. Okay. We're going to take a brief break. I'm going to send it over to you, Brad, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
The Cal Poly Department of Industrial and Manufacturing Engineering is seeking requests from companies for students' senior projects. Requests could include design, automation, or analytics, and should be emailed by Monday to TFREED, that's tfreed, at calpoly.edu. Brad Kyle here, and we do hope that you're enjoying the programming that you're hearing here on KCBX, your public radio station. And you know we're in our fall pledge drive. We need your support now more than ever. So we're asking you to donate so that we can continue to bring you programs just like the one that you're listening to right now. An important local program about national topics, Central Coast Voices. We also bring you great music as well, and I'll be sharing that with you tonight from 8 until 10 on Across the Tracks. So I'm asking you to visit the website now, kcbx.org, or call us at 1-800-549-8855 and donate. It's radio supported by people like you, and right now we need that support more than ever. And if you've already donated, thanks.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, Loud, the History of Reggaeton. A new podcast takes you from the Panamanian buses to the shores of Puerto Rico to the streets of New York City.
We used to record a lot, and he used to sell the cassettes to the bus drivers.
It all went down on the buses.
That's next time on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, what leaked documents reveal about what Facebook executives knew. They knew the platform was spreading misinformation, that in some countries, Facebook was being used by human traffickers and to incite violence. And that Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, was toxic for many teenage girls. Join us.
Back to school is pretty rough this year.
It's been a bit of an organizational nightmare for everybody, from the administration all the way down to the kids.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Testing and screening and masking and quarantining. Classroom realities next time on Marketplace.
Ahead on your Thursday here on KCBX, it's Latino USA up at 2 o'clock, followed by Fresh Air at 3, and then Marketplace at 4. Right now, let's return to Chris Kington Barker and her guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, and welcome back. My guests today are Julissa Pena, Executive Director, and Crystal Canella, Staff Attorney from the Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center. And we're taking a deeper look at the increase in the number of accompanied minors that are crossing the U.S. and Mexico border, its impact on the Central Coast immigrant population, and how Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center is making its best efforts to respond. As a reminder, if you have a question for today's guests or a comment, you can call us at 805-549-8855, or you can email your questions or comments to voices@kcbx.org. And Crystal, we talked a little bit before about the difference for unaccompanied minors to receive asylum versus being eligible for the special immigrant juvenile status. And can you break down that again so that listeners can understand that, of who can qualify for that? What is the difference? And are there challenges about one or the other or both?
Yeah, so for these specific minors, unaccompanied minors crossing, they have a much higher likelihood of not only qualifying for special immigrant juvenile status, but also being granted SIJS, which is the shorthand. But whereas asylum, on the other hand, has a much more stringent eligibility, and it's much more harder to qualify. We have children who have tried also an asylum case and a SIJS case at the same time to maximize their immigration relief possibilities, with the knowledge that they most likely will not win their asylum case, unfortunately, and we are counting on them getting their SIJS approved, because this special visa is designated specifically for them. It's very unique to them versus asylum has many more applicants, that it's harder to show that what they're experiencing in their home country, although it may They may have fled because they are afraid of conditions that are in their country, whether it's war, violence. For instance, there are females that come to the U.S. because women being targeted specifically and being harmed and kidnapped. But when you come to the U.S., unless you can show very specifically how that impacted you, what they did to you or your family, it's very, very, very hard, even when you do have sufficient proof that you've been harmed, to still qualify for asylum. Whereas SIJs, these children are almost past the hurdle just by being under 21, unmarried, and then showing that they've been abused, abandoned, or neglected by one or both parents. Unfortunately, most of the clients we've seen, or even, I should say not clients, but children that we've done intakes with, they generally almost always qualify for it. Unfortunately, one of those three things they have experienced. Yes. So it's much more likely for them to get that special visa.
And where do the children stay when they're on that status? Do they stay with their sponsors?
Yeah, so they would still be with their sponsor during that time. And when we're helping them, they're still with their sponsor. So this would be something for them to get so that they can eventually get their residency, but that won't impact what the sponsor they were already assigned during that time.
What length of time are we talking about for this to occur? When you talked about it being front loaded and then you talk about handing that off, and it sounds like this is not a quick process. And if we're talking about what, over 2000, I mean, it's just astounding, the numbers. So how long could this take reasonably?
So I guess comparatively speaking, for immigration relief and visa, this is probably shorter than other visas that can take maybe decades to receive your residency through a different form of immigration relief, but it's still long. So for instance, like I was saying, with just the family court side or the state court side and trying to get all the details you need to fill out all those forms, it's very time consuming. And so it could take a few months just to get those forms filled out. But then even on top of that, it's very easy to get these forms rejected when you first submit them to the court for small technicalities. So even once you have everything completed, you may be going back and forth for a few weeks or a few months trying to get it approved. And then after that point, you're waiting to get the predicate order from the judge. Once it's been approved, you're waiting to receive that so then you can proceed with the immigration side. And once you start the immigration side, you use the order that you got from state court in addition to the I-360 form from immigration, which shows the child is eligible for special immigrant juvenile status. And from there, once we submit that application and get it approved, we're waiting a few years to then maybe have the child be able to even apply for the residency. So it can really range from 3 to 5 years, and it ranges to not just on like the work side, but also based on when the priority date of when we can file these things and when the a visa is available for the child. There's still a waiting period between that. So the dates change. So it's not a consistent time frame that I can say, oh, within a year, you're going to get this status. It ranges all the time based off of whether there's a backlog of...
If we're talking about years, maybe 5 years, what happens if the child ages out?
So thankfully, once we've already gone through the process of getting the predicate order, as long as they were under 21 when they applied for that, that won't impact them. It's more of a concern if the child comes to us once they're 20 and we're just speeding to like beat the clock so that we can get all that paperwork in and secure it. So Yeah, once we start the family court side and it gets approved, then that's not a concern, at least, but it's still just a waiting game of them getting their residency here in the U.S.
A couple of years ago or a year ago, there was a lot of discussion around how are you keeping track of these individuals? How do you know where these children are going? How do you know when they're connected with sponsors and where those sponsors are? Has that been fixed? Is there a system? I'm not trying to stump you.
No, I'm just, there hasn't really been a fix. Kind of like what Julissa was telling you, even with just finding the sponsors, there isn't even really a system to do that to ensure these children have a sponsor. It's more so the child's responsibility to ensure that they can even get themselves a sponsor by maybe themselves knowing contact information or whoever, like the family member that told them to cross the border, maybe including a note with them or something of the sort to show that, hey, I'm coming to the U.S. and these are the people you can get in contact with as my sponsors. So it's not really a system. It's not really a set in place to ensure that when these kids cross, there will be someone that they can go to.
Is that something from your experience in the system that's being talked about of, you know, we have an issue here and this is something that people need to kind of figure out? Or is it just something that is kind of continuing to go on and there are battles to wage here?
I mean, definitely there's many immigrant advocates, right? From the Immigrant Legal Resource Center, for instance, from organizations like KIND and Young Center for Immigrant Children, advocating for the Department of Homeland Security to come up with a system, right, to a better system to keep track of these children, right, and where they're at as well to locate them. That so we know that there was a huge problem when the zero tolerance policy was put in place by the previous administration, separating families, and we're still there's so many children being separated from families because they implemented this policy without having a system in place to keep track of who was the parent, right? When they separate them, where would they find them? And so, yeah, there's still a number of kids that are separated from their parents because of this. Yeah.
Can you know, we've talked in general terms about what this looks like and the challenges for kids. Crystal, can you talk from your heart for a minute about maybe something that's touched you that is representative of the kinds of things that attorneys or you too, Julissa, of what you face and the families that you're dealing with and the children that are coming into your custody?
Yeah, so I think just for starters, working with these children, it's hard. It's hard work to work with them, but and I say that it's hard mostly just because you're talking about such delicate things with them, and it's hard to get them to open up to you. And not even just open up to you, but maybe realize that what they've experienced, like the degree of maybe abuse that they've experienced and that they don't really understand that it's abuse, and trying to talk to them and get them comfortable to share those things. So for instance, I have two siblings that had been with one parent in their home country, and the mother had previously already left the home country to come to the U.S., to try to support the children eventually. And so she had come here trying to make a life for herself to eventually allow those children, those two boys, to come with her. So during that time, they were with the dad who he had abused them both physically and mentally. He had neglected them. These children had been forced to work as young as like 13 in the fields, and then being forced to work so that then they could turn over the money they got from working to the parent, or, you know, having this parent who abuses alcohol and then is taking out their rage on these young children, or exposing them to the abuse they inflict on their partner because of these issues. So it is very difficult to get these children to open up sometimes, but it is one of the best feelings after I've been working with them consistently and having multiple conversations as I fill out these forms, to see them get comfortable with me and start sharing how it actually felt to be in their home country, how their parent actually treated them, and how, you know, they just wanted to find some peace because this parent was either abusive to them or their mother, and they were just looking for peace and wanting to reunite with the mother that had already come to the United States. So it's really wonderful once they are able to finally cross and, you know, be united with the mom. And, you know, on top of it, with all this COVID, different arrangements, like finally meeting those clients also in person and being able to connect with them and finally provide some concrete form of relief that they would be eligible for after everything they've been through.
One of the, I think, things that I've heard periodically from people is the belief that when individuals intervene with individuals who are coming in, immigrating in to, into the country without the proper process, that there's attempts to help them create a story of getting here, create stories about abuse, or create stories. How do you respond to that in terms of what you've seen in your experience?
I definitely, unfortunately, like I said, like, I definitely, there isn't a story that's being created. Unfortunately, these are the things these children have experienced. And like anyone else who's been through a trauma, you may not be forthcoming about that information. Or if it's what you know, if it was your normal in your home country, you may not even be able to identify it initially. So it's not about creating a story or an experience that was never there. It's about showing these children that what they experienced wasn't okay. It shouldn't be their normal, that there were problems, and that they can trust us and share those experiences, so they can understand what was wrong. And I think that may be misconstrued, like you're saying, as creating a story versus helping children that have been through trauma and have a hard time communicating what they've been through.
Yeah. If you can create something better and something more through the efforts that you're doing right now, what are the things that you feel like really need to happen pretty urgently that would be at the top of your list for your organization or for the kind of outreach that you're trying to do?
For starters, just the us being able to expand our ability to take on these cases. And like Julissa was saying, to create more of a holistic approach, to not just be able to provide legal services, but also support services, whether it's mental health or helping them with the U.S. education system once they're here, things of that sort, that not only are there very few to none organizations here in the Central Coast providing legal or support services, it's hard when we only have limited funding as a nonprofit to help such a large amount of unaccompanied minors here in the Central Coast.
Are you looking to, do you have those kind of resources or personnel or volunteers within your organization that do outreach for mental health or for assisting with learning language, or, you know, where do you find those resources, and are you faced with having to create them?
Oh my goodness. So that's where we're at right now, right? So since experiencing an increase of unaccompanied minors here in our organization, I saw the need of, you know, creating a case management position that would help us connect these kids with other resources. And so something else that we've been doing, striving for that case management position in the future, is strengthening our relationships with mental health service orgs, with other schools, to try and communicate better and not only how to identify these kids and get them the legal services that they need, but to also direct the kids that we have to these support services, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, the need to have a case management manager in our organization is very important, right? Because that person would make sure that this person is getting access to these support services. And so these are kids, like I said, that there's language barriers, right? Economic barriers. And so there needs to be someone that walks that child through that process and accessing those support services.
Yeah. How difficult has it been for the families that are taking these children in to all of a sudden take this on as well? Because it sounds like with the court, with all of that, that's got to be very time consuming. And when you've got a younger child, you can't just say, here's a bus token, you know, go down to court and take care of it.
Yeah, that's such a great question, Chris. So these kids, most of these kids are being reunited with family members, right? Sponsors that are already facing economic challenges themselves, who also have language barriers, right? That economic deprivation is just exacerbated by adding another family member, and it's tough, and there's lack of support services for that family. We do what we can. We've been able to apply for some cash assistance grants with the Hispanics in Philanthropy Foundation. But it's limited.
And I want to point out that you are not only in Santa Barbara, you also have an attorney in Santa Maria as well, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So we have two offices, one in Santa Barbara and one in Santa Maria.
Okay. And are the resource challenges different in the North Santa Barbara County than what you're experiencing in Southern?
Yeah, many people often think, right, that it's tougher because there's a larger immigrant community up north, but really it's pretty much all along the central coast. We are limited in resources all over SLOW, Santa Barbara, and Ventura.
So if someone is listening and wanted to become more informed, or was saying, you know, well, I didn't know that, or I might be interested in being more supportive, but I still have some questions, or, you know, how can I get involved for those people that do want to reach out? How can they get involved?
Yeah.
How can they get more informed?
Yeah, I definitely encourage them to visit our website and to get in touch with us via phone or via email. Our website is sbimmigrantdefense.org. And so you're able to see all our programs and our contact information on there.
Okay. And, you know, we just have a couple of minutes, but I want to make sure that I give those couple of minutes to both of you. So I'm going to start with you, Crystal, about something that you want to make sure that you're able to get across. And what would that be?
Yeah, I think also, like you were saying, having a way for people to contact us
And what is the website?
The website is sbimmigrantdefense.org.
Okay, great.
And ensuring that, you know, these children really know what immigration relief is available to them, because it is specifically unique to them, special immigrant juvenile status, and not enough children know that they have this relief available to them. So really just spreading that word, and, you know, if anyone knows anyone that they think may qualify, just contacting our office.
Are you looking for individuals to volunteer their time in terms of doing things like case management or care management in the interim when you don't have the funding for that?
We would love to. If there's someone that has the time and a little bit of experience working with children, that would be very, very helpful. Yeah.
And who would be the best contact for them to get a hold of if there was that kind of interest so that you could vet them and see whether there's a fit there?
Yeah, they can contact me directly, Chris. My email's on the website as well. It's my first name, julisa@sbimmigrantdefense.org.
Okay. And then what about for those individuals who are attorneys or paralegals who might have an interest in volunteering their time? Do you still have openings for that?
Yeah. So paralegals, we currently have 3 interns that are helping us out. We're probably okay with the paralegal, but of course that may definitely change early next year as we take on additional cases. So I still encourage them to get in touch with us.
Okay. And how about for you, what would you like to finish up with here?
Yeah, I think one of my biggest goals with everything going on at the border has been to really educate the community on how the conditions at the border have impacted us locally. And so much of the public focus around unaccompanied minors has focused on the conditions in detention facilities, right, and where they are housed. Right. But I really think that we need to start shifting the conversation away from how to prevent these children from entering and instead to talk about how we can assist and welcome unaccompanied children who are present on the Central Coast.
Well, I appreciate that. And I want to thank my guests today, Julisa Pena, Executive Director, Crystal Canella, Staff Attorney from the Santa Barbara County Immigrant Legal Defense Center, for joining me in today's show. Next week, Fred Monroe will be here, and he'll be speaking with guests from the Literacy for Life about how they work to transform the community and empower individuals by removing barriers to success while strengthening relationships through the power of literacy. Central Coast Voices has been sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX and through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you so much for joining us today on Central Coast Voices.